From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moscowane, sitting in for Terry Gross, who's on assignment. On today's Fresh Air, the politics behind the misery in Rwanda. The Tutsi rebels have declared victory and have called for the establishment of a new government there. Meanwhile, the refugee crisis continues. We'll talk with journalist and Human Rights Watch investigator Frank Smythe. He'll give us some background on the Rwandan Patriotic Front, who they are, and what they're planning for the future of Rwanda. Also, we'll talk with Pablo Medina, a Cuban-American poet and writer whose exile from Cuba is the fuel for his first novel. And commentator Maureen Corrigan reviews The Bird Artist by Howard Norman. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Senate Judiciary Committee has unanimously approved the Supreme Court nomination of Stephen Breyer. His name has been sent to the full Senate for consideration. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Although all 18 members of the Judiciary Committee voted to approve the nomination, liberal Democrat Howard Metzenbaum and conservative Republican Charles Grassley expressed reservations. Metzenbaum said that Breyer's voting record on the lower court was too heavily weighted in favor of big business and against the little guy, and Grassley said his concern was that Breyer had too broad a view of the Constitution. Most senators, however, praised the nominee as a moderate and a pragmatist. And Committee Chairman Joseph Biden said he expected the full Senate to vote on the nomination by late this week or early next week. So far, no senator has indicated he or she will vote against Breyer. President Clinton's first Supreme Court nominee, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, was approved by a 96-3 vote. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
President Clinton says he's open to any solution that controls the mushrooming costs of health care. He told Republicans today what Congress needs to do is what will work for ordinary Americans. He spoke to the nation's governors who are gathered in Boston today. The president's comments came after Senate Republican leader Bob Dole told the group a complete overhaul of the U.S. health care system would cost too much and be too bureaucratic. Mr. Clinton says he'll veto any bill that doesn't cover all Americans, but he's agreeing with Dole that Congress ought to work as long as needed to finish the job. An Israeli soldier has been shot and killed in an ambush near the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian group Hamas has claimed responsibility for the murder. NPR's Paul Miller reports from Jerusalem.
Palestinian witnesses said an Israeli army officer was shot in the head when his patrol stopped at the edge of the frontier area between Gaza and Egypt. Israel still controls the border crossings into Egypt. Reports say Palestinian gunmen broke through a security fence to get into position for the attack. Israel radio says the army patrol fired back, but the gunmen escaped into Gaza. Israel has asked the Palestinian police to find them. Hamas said it carried out the attack in revenge for the death of two Palestinians in rioting on Sunday. Those riots took place at the other end of the Gaza Strip, at the crossing point into Israel, and involved fighting between thousands of Palestinians and Israeli soldiers. I'm Paul Miller in Jerusalem.
The relief agency Doctors Without Borders is asking the United Nations to send observers to Rwanda. The group says it thinks efforts to help Rwandans in refugee camps should now be focused on getting them back home. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen more than 4 points to 3,751. Trading is very heavy. In over-the-counter trading, the NASDAQ Composite Index is down 3.5 points at 719. This is NPR. Secretary of State Warren Christopher has met in Syria with President Hafez al-Assad. Christopher is trying to secure his support for the latest Mideast peace negotiations. There's a dispute between Syria and Israel over the Golan Heights, which has held back a major peace settlement. Syria wants Israel to promise to turn over the Golan and remove Jewish settlers. Israel wants Syria to be more specific about what kind of peace it's offering in exchange for the territory. Astronomers worldwide say they're dazzled by the show produced by the Shoemaker Levy 9 comet. Comet fragments are crashing into Jupiter. The ninth fragment struck the planet this morning. NPR's Joe Palca has more.
Reports of sightings of the fragment collisions have come from nearly every major observatory in the world. The most recent fragment, Fragment K, was seen clearly by telescopes in Australia. At the McDonnell Observatory in Fort Davis, Texas, astronomers took a single picture showing the impact sites of five different comet fragments. The sites appear as a series of dark splotches strung out in a line in Jupiter's southern hemisphere. At Earth's south pole, astronomers fought high winds and bitter cold to clear off their telescope. They were rewarded by clear pictures of the fireballs caused by five of the comet fragments. Astronomers are now looking forward to yet another remarkable event. Starting with fragment Q, tomorrow, three consecutive fragments will fall on nearly the exact same spot on Jupiter, creating, as one astronomer put it, quite a mess. This is Joe Palca in Washington.
Tehran Radio is denying Israel's charge that it planned a huge fatal bombing in Buenos Aires, Argentina, yesterday. The state-run radio quotes the Iranian foreign ministry as saying Israel carried out the attack to advance its own, quote, illegitimate political objectives. The blast devastated a seven-story building. 26 people died. More than 130 people are hurt. The building housed several Jewish organizations. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. The Tutsi rebel army has declared an end to the civil war in Rwanda, and yesterday they named a new government. This rapid change of events in Rwanda has radically shifted the country's balance of power, with the minority Tutsis now in control. Millions of Hutus are fleeing Rwanda into Zaire, and relief organizations there are completely overwhelmed. The Tutsis were last in control in Rwanda in the late 1950s, when the country was a Belgian colony. After independence in 1962, the majority Hutus took over in a bloody uprising, and many Tutsis fled to Uganda. It is these expatriate Tutsis who make up most of the rebel army, the Rwandan Patriotic Front. They began their moves into Rwanda in 1990 and forced the government into signing a power-sharing accord last year. The mass slaughter of Tutsis and opposition Hutus in Rwanda over the past few months was a desperate attempt by extremist Hutus to stop this move towards power-sharing. We've invited journalist Frank Smythe to provide some background on the situation. Smythe has been covering Rwanda for The Nation, The New Republic, and The Village Voice, and he's an investigator for Africa Watch. I asked him what the Rwandan Patriotic Front wants.
The RPF was looking primarily for the right of repatriation to Rwanda. These are these expatriate Tutsi refugees have been living outside Rwanda for the past several decades. So their primary goal was to earn the right of repatriation to Rwanda so that people, their own Tutsi families, would then have the right of returning to Rwanda and hopefully the right to gain some land. That is why Hutu forces feared them and didn't want the Tutsi to return, because the Tutsi had dominated Rwanda. They were the major landowners up until the late 1950s, when they were violently overthrown. So at bottom, this was really a struggle over land.
Did they want to play a part in the government, or were they more interested in getting land back?
I think the rank-and-file fighters were interested primarily in getting land back, but the Tutsi leadership certainly was interested in playing a role in the government. Their problem is although they were militarily superior to Rwanda's Hutu government, they found themselves in a position where if they tried to seize power, something I think they could have done militarily, they still would have represented, the Tutsis in Rwanda would have represented no more than 14% of the total population. So no matter what they did militarily, they would eventually be forced to share power in some way with Hutu. So I think their other goal in terms of the war was to achieve a negotiated settlement.
Now, there were some peace accords that were signed in August of 1993. These are the Arusha Accords, is that right?
That's right.
What was signed back then?
The Arusha Accord was a very good agreement which would have ended hostilities between the Tutsi guerrillas and the Rwandan government. It provided a formula for power sharing in which the president's cabinet would have been divided equally between his own ruling party officials as well as Hutu opposition parties, which have been a third force throughout this whole conflict, as well as the representatives of the Tutsi guerrillas. But what happened on August 6th is that there were forces loyal to who had been part of the president's government, who were opposed to this peace plan and thought the president had gone too far in his reconciliation. According to Belgium, these forces are responsible for then assassinating the president, then sending the presidential guard soldiers to to slaughter the Hutu opposition along with their, in most cases, spouses and children. And then their ruling party radio then incited Hutu masses and militias to then begin what amounts now to a genocidal slaughter against Tutsi.
Is the current fighting in Rwanda a struggle then between Hutus and Tutsis? Can we understand it in those rather simple terms?
Well, I think that's too simple, but certainly that's an element. I think there's been a lot of discussion about whether or not this is a political war or a tribal war, with people taking very firm positions on both sides of the spectrum. And I think that it's both. It's impossible to separate the two. What you had here was an historic ethnic or tribal animosity between the Hutu and Tutsi for several centuries, rooted in the fact that there was a shortage, has always been a shortage of land in Rwanda. The Tutsi monarchy dominated Rwanda for three centuries before the Hutu violently overthrew them in 1959, killing anywhere from 20 to 100,000 Tutsi. And that slaughter was described then by Bertrand Russell, the philosopher, as the most systematic and horrible massacre the world had witnessed had witnessed to that date since the slaughter of the Jews by the Nazis. So certainly Rwanda has a precedent for this kind of violence, and this ethnic or tribal hatred, whatever you want to call it, is real. What happened since then is Hutu have been in power ever since. The Tutsi in Rwanda have been marginalized, and in addition, the Tutsi refugees of this first slaughter have been marginalized in neighboring countries, most of them being concentrated in Uganda. What happened when they came back in 1990 in the form of an invasion force, a lot of the Hutu peasants, I believe, had the impression that this would mean, if the Tutsi were to take power, a restoration of the Tutsi monarchy, a restoration of the Tutsi landowning class, and ultimately the displacement of most Hutu in the country.
Frank Smythe is our guest on Fresh Air today. He's a freelance journalist and an investigative consultant to Human Rights Watch Arms Project. And we're talking about the current situation in Rwanda. You're the author of a report called Arming Rwanda. This was a report you did for Human Rights Watch. Who has been arming Rwanda over the last decades?
Over the last decades, historically, Rwanda got most of its weapons from Belgium, Belgian FAL, as well as some German G3 automatic rifles. And Belgium, of course, is Rwanda's former colonial ruler. But what happened in 1990, when the war started with the invasion of Rwanda from Uganda of Tutsi guerrillas, is that Belgium has an explicit policy against providing any lethal aid or arms to a country at war. So Belgium continued to provide training and non-lethal arms, but cut off all arms deliveries to Rwanda. France, on the other hand, when it saw this was taking place, feared that that could result in Rwanda being overthrown by the Tutsi guerrillas. And while Rwandans identify the conflict largely in terms of Hutu and Tutsi, France identified the conflict in terms of English-speaking Tutsi guerrillas backed by English-speaking Uganda and a French-speaking government with which France had a military cooperation agreement. So France then, in 1990, became Rwanda's main military patron, and much of the weapons came from France.
In terms of who was armed, the Hutus got most of the supplies?
The Hutus got most of the supplies, although the Tutsi guerrillas are also very well armed. Some of the weapons that they claim to have stolen from Uganda include Katusha Soviet-made multiple rocket launchers, which can cover an area wider and longer than a soccer field with a concentration of incoming fire. So certainly, I would say that both sides are very well armed.
Now, the Rwandan rebels have claimed victory, and they say they want to install a new government. What kind of government do they have in mind?
That's a very good question, and that is the basic question for the future of Rwanda. They claim that they are interested in forming a multi-party and multi-ethnic government, and that is necessary for the future stability of Rwanda, and the Tutsi guerrillas need to be encouraged and pushed by the international community to make that the case. The problem is that a great deal of the moderate Hutu opposition was murdered in Rwanda, although there are some people who have survived and some political leaders who have survived who need to be cultivated and incorporated into this power-sharing agreement. The other thing that's going to be necessary to make this government work would be to bring those Hutu extremists from the Rump government, the previous government responsible for the genocide, to find a mechanism to bring them to trial in an international forum to discourage the Tutsi guerrillas as well as Tutsi fighters from exacting retribution on their own. For the future of Rwanda, the big question is, how are you going to get Hutus to believe that the Tutsi guerrillas are not out for revenge and are going to kill them? And likewise, how are you going to reassure Tutsi civilians, the survivors, that they can return to Rwanda?
Well, that's what the Rwandan rebels have said, that everyone's safety will be guaranteed. There will not be reprisals against the populace. Can they be believed when they say that?
I think the only thing that is going to convince both Tutsi and Hutu civilians in Rwanda that either side is not going to exact retribution is to stabilize the situation, and I think it may require the deployment of UN peacekeepers for some time or OAU peacekeepers with the support of the UN to give civilians the idea that you no longer have to fear from guerrillas or bands of roving Hutu militias, that there will be some visibly neutral armed force in Rwanda that can maintain some kind of order and prevent these revengeful killings.
The Tutsis have, they killed an archbishop in the past. Their past is not perfectly clean, is it?
Absolutely not. In the beginning, before this crisis, from 1990 to 1993, the Tutsi guerrillas were responsible for a number of human rights abuses, especially the execution of civilians that they accused of collaborating with the government, as well as the summary executions of military prisoners. In addition, there's credible evidence that they forcibly dislocated hundreds, if not thousands, of civilians and forced an unknown number of them, certainly hundreds, it seems, into slave labor. The murder of the archbishop was a horrendous crime. And certainly the RPF will have to answer for it. If there is an international tribunal held, then that's one of the crimes that also would have to be investigated.
You said that the RPF is relatively small, what, 12,000, 15,000 people?
That's right.
How has a group that small been able to basically be victorious against the Hutu-led government in Rwanda? How have they been able to do that?
Well, the difference between the Rwandan army and the Tutsi guerrillas is the Rwandan army is a classic despot army where drinking, rape, ill-disciplined renegade soldiers acting in a rampaging manner has always been tolerated and by some officers it seems encouraged. The Tutsi guerrillas, on the other hand, struck me as a highly professional, extraordinarily well-motivated, well-trained, and very professionally led guerrilla force. Just to give you an example, when I was in Rwanda, you'd see soldiers being very menacing at checkpoints. Foreign relief officials told me that they didn't like posting Western women near army bases because they were afraid they could become targets of rape. I visited a military hospital where soldiers who had been wounded several days before were suffering from an open femur fracture and gangrene, and I was told they weren't being treated because the doctors don't work weekends. Mm. So certainly this is not a very well motivated or disciplined force. The Tutsi guerrillas, on the other hand, I visited their base camp in Malindi during a ceasefire, and they were constantly marching and singing war songs and constantly maintaining their military ranks and military discipline. I mean, I guess it would seem like a boot camp to most lay observers, but certainly the Tutsi guerrillas always kept their forces in line. They didn't tolerate disobedience or renegade activity. And I think that certainly paid off now in the fact that they were able to organize their forces to maintain their command structure. to be both mobile and at the same time to be able to concentrate forces to fight the government. And I think ultimately that's why they were able to defeat the Rwandan army. Let me also say, though, that observers who were familiar with both sides, including American intelligence observers, I think there was a consensus that the Tutsi guerrillas were far stronger than the Rwandan army. And when this conflict began, I think many people, and I was one of those people, expected the Tutsi guerrillas to take power much sooner than they actually did.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we have to take a short break. And our guest on Fresh Air is Frank Smyth. He's a freelance journalist, also an investigative consultant to Human Rights Watch, their arms project. And we're talking about Rwanda. It's a country he has been writing about for some time now. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Frank Smyth is our guest today on Fresh Air, and he's a freelance journalist, and we're talking about Rwanda. Have there been stories or any evidence of abuses by the RPF in the last couple of weeks since they have moved into Rwanda from Uganda?
Well, there's certainly been charges that RPF guerrillas fired mortars indiscriminately and recklessly into Hutu civilians, killing dozens of them, as well as creating a stampede, which killed dozens more. So certainly the RPF are guilty of human rights violations and the indiscriminate use of firepower. But overall, their human rights record is nothing like the Rumpf government's.
What about the fact that there are now so many refugees in who are fleeing Rwanda? Do you think the Tutsis are responsible for that at all?
The Tutsis are certainly responsible for some of that, but the main reason that these Hutu civilians have such fear of the Tutsi guerrillas is they've been told that by the Rump government over its ruling party radio. This is the same radio that incited Hutu militias to slaughter any and all Tutsi, also was saying things that Tutsis were inhuman and, very strong racist propaganda. And not only were they inhuman, but if the Tutsi guerrillas come, they're going to kill you and your family and children. So you have to fight them. You have to fight them to the death. So when the Hutu civilians saw that their side, the Hutu militias, were losing to the Tutsi guerrillas, I think it was natural for them to believe this propaganda and to then presume that the Tutsi guerrillas would then kill them in revenge. I think that was a reasonable presumption on their part. And, of course, it triggered a mass panic of all these Hutus to flee in the Zaire. But there has been there's little evidence, although there were some abuses by the Tutsi guerrillas, there's little evidence that they have been killing Hutu civilians in revenge. But nonetheless, these Hutu civilians fear the Tutsi guerrillas because that's what they've been told and been led to believe by the propaganda coming out of the Rump government's radio.
When you mention the Rump government, what are you referring to?
This is the Hutu, what Belgium calls the Hutu extremists, the people whom allegedly assassinated the president and then directed the militias and as well as elements of the Rwandan army to begin killing both the Hutu opposition and any and all Tutsi civilians. Since the death of the president, these people declared an interim government with them in charge, and that's why I think the term Rump government is appropriate.
And where are they?
They are now, some of them are in the safe haven created by France, and one of the problems is that the human rights community is asking France to arrest these people and to hold them so that they could eventually be tried in international tribunal. Some of them are also have fled to Zaire and are now in Zaire near Goma.
And are these the people that, the RPF are going to have to negotiate with in order to establish a coalition government?
The RPF has refused to negotiate with members of the Rump government who are responsible for genocide. Instead, the RPF is going to have to find the moderate Hutu leaders who survived. And remember, there were several opposition parties, Hutu opposition parties, that first were created in the 1990s, which were both opposed to the hardline Hutus, but were quite independent of the Tutsi guerrillas. Many of these opposition party leaders have unfortunately been assassinated, but there are quite a few who have survived, and this is going to have to form the nucleus of a power-sharing agreement between the Tutsi guerrillas and these surviving Hutus.
Let me ask you, though, if Tutsis made up about 15% of the population in Rwanda, the numbers of people killed since April is anywhere between 200,000 and 500,000. How many Tutsis remain, you think, are still alive
in
Rwanda?
That's a very good question. Let me just add, certain State Department officials believe that the death toll may actually be higher, that the figure of a 500,000 may be a conservative number, although it's very difficult to tell at this point. There are two groups of Tutsis that were involved in this conflict. One are the Tutsi civilians who have always lived in Rwanda, who were between, estimates run between 9 and 14% of the population. They have been largely wiped out. Most of them, it seems, have now been murdered. The other group of Tutsi involved in the conflict are the expatriate refugees, who the individuals and their families who have lived outside of Rwanda since the 1950s. Most of these people have survived. But the problem is that the Hutu in Rwanda are very distrustful of them, not only because of the fact that they're Tutsi, but the fact that they've been living, most of them have been living in Uganda for the past 30 years. So there are Tutsi left in Rwanda, but basically the Tutsi that were there were mostly killed, and you have a new group of now repatriating Tutsi refugees that now, I think, probably comprise the majority of the Tutsi population in Rwanda.
UN Secretary General Boutros-Boutros-Ghali called the world response to Rwanda a scandal. Do you agree?
Absolutely. I think it was an horrendous scandal. In addition to not doing anything in terms of trying to stop the genocide, the world was even reluctant, especially the United States, about calling it genocide. And I think that was that contributed to the violence. The Hutu extremists that are responsible for this violence carried it out with the idea that they could encourage the presidential guard to kill the Hutu opposition, the militias to kill all Tutsi civilians, in the hope they could provoke some kind of popular, quote-unquote, Hutu uprising against Tutsi, which would then leave both Tutsi civilians and guerrillas dead. And in the end, this block of Hutu extremists would be the only ones left standing, and they would then retain power in Rwanda. The world's reluctance and President Clinton's reluctance to call it genocide, I think, gave them the impression they can get away with this, as opposed to denouncing it in the beginning and saying, even if you succeed in killing all your enemies, we will bring you to trial and in an international forum for crimes of genocide.
Do you see, though, Rwanda as a test of world resolve in a post-Cold War world?
I think it's a test, but I think it's a very bad test. I think what we're seeing now, there's been this feeling after the Cold War that there's only one superpower. And I think what we're seeing now is countries like France asserting their power. And France's prime minister said in Paris on national television that one of the main reasons France is acting in Rwanda is to demonstrate that it is a world power. And I think what we're seeing is that instead of the world getting together under the guise of the United Nations and finding a collective response to the problem, which was necessary, I think what you saw is the world saying, well, if France wants to go in, despite the fact that it has a long association with the people doing the killing, and despite the fact that it may have an ulterior motive, we'll allow France to go in because no other country is willing to do the job. And I think that was simply a disgrace.
Well, Frank Smyth, thank you for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Frank Smyth has been covering Rwanda for The Nation, The New Republic, and The Village Voice. He's also an investigator for Africa Watch. I'm Artie Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air. ¶¶
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Artie Moscowane. Coming up, the marks of birth. Pablo Medina says his family fled Cuba for the United States as the militia was bearing down, asking vague questions of his father and taking furniture from his house. Medina's first novel draws from his experience of being uprooted from that Caribbean island and resettling in New York City. And Maureen Corrigan has a review of The Bird Artist, a new novel by Howard Norman that's set in Newfoundland. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. France has recognized the new rebel government in Rwanda. French Foreign Minister Alain Juppé says it's now up to the new government to care for its people. Juppé says France will start to withdraw its 2,500 troops from Rwanda by the end of the month. They're supposed to be completely gone by mid-August. He says the troops have accomplished their mission of protecting innocent civilians. Gunmen in Colombia have ambushed and killed an army general who was the head of a big anti-guerrilla campaign. The general was shot while driving in a convoy. The attack is believed to be the work of left-wing guerrillas. The BBC's Timothy Ross reports from Bogota.
Major General Carlos Julio Gil was one of Colombia's most respected counterinsurgency specialists, commander of the 4th Army Division, and he was leading operations in 6 southeastern states against a rebel offensive. His convoy was ambushed on the outskirts of the city of Villavicencio with a big remote detonated mine and sniper bullets. General Gil is the highest-ranking officer to be killed in Colombia's guerrilla war for 20 years, and it's a serious morale blow. Plans to attack senior officers and military bases had been detected for some time, and over the past week, a series of raids have cost the lives of 22 soldiers. Although several guerrilla commanders have been captured this year and shipments of ammunition and explosives intercepted, the rebel strike capacity has not been affected, and their attacks are expected to be stepped up over the next 20 days, leading up to the inauguration of a new president on August the 7th.
Timothy Ross reporting. Honda has announced plans to boost automobile production in North America. That would mean the addition of 1,100 jobs in plants and research and development facilities. Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
Of all the Japanese auto companies, Honda already has the most extensive operations in North America. Now the company says it will add to that over the next 5 years. Honda's automobile production capacity will increase from the current 610,000 vehicles annually up to 720,000. The company will also begin producing 50% more engines at its Ohio engine plant, and U.S.-based research and development for new models will be doubled. Auto analysts say the moves make sense, especially given the way the strength of the Japanese yen has driven up the price of cars designed and built in Japan. In fact, Honda says it will export many of the additional U.S.-built cars to Europe and back to Japan. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
Stephen Breyer has been unanimously approved by the Senate Judiciary Committee to become a Supreme Court justice. He'll likely be confirmed by the full Senate later this week. The committee's 10 Democrats and 8 Republicans voted to recommend approval of Breyer's nomination. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials lost 7 points today to close at 3,748. Declines led advances by a margin of 10 to 9. Trading was heavy. 252 million shares changed hands. This is NPR. The Clinton administration has decided to keep the Bush administration's ban on the use of marijuana for medical use. Advocates have asked President Clinton to lift the ban. They say dying patients believe it helps reduce their pain. They also point out that several different groups, like the legislatures of California and Missouri, support lifting the ban. Privately funded studies may still go ahead with their work to conclusively prove if marijuana does have health benefits. In a special 50th anniversary report, the World Bank is setting a new agenda for the next decade. Linda Fasulo reports.
The World Bank was founded in 1944 to help foster recovery in post-war Europe and Japan. Since then, it has lent $300 billion to 140 countries. But now, in its anniversary report, Bank President Louis Preston says his organization is changing its approach in order to meet new challenges. These include investing in people through expanded programs for education, healthcare, nutrition, and family planning, protecting the environment, and stimulating the private sector. But the report emphasizes that developing countries must also be politically committed to these goals and effectively implement them. And the report says the Bank of the Future will measure its success by the quality and effectiveness of its services and not by the volume of its financial commitments. The World Bank plans to provide $200 billion in loans over the next decade. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
The government says the U.S. trade gap ballooned in May by more than 7.5%. The Commerce Department says the overall trade deficit jumped to nearly $9.2 billion. The agency says Americans' appetite for imports set a new record high for the third straight month. Rising oil prices pushed America's foreign oil bill up by nearly $340 million last month. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Although Pablo Medina fled from Cuba with his family after the Communist Revolution in 1960, he has never left his homeland emotionally. As a writer, poet, and translator, Cuba and family have been the focus of much of his writing. He has 2 books of poetry, Pork Rind and Cuban Songs, and Arching into the Afterlife, and a memoir, Exiled Memories, A Cuban Childhood. Medina's first novel, The Marks of Birth, takes place in an unnamed Caribbean island. It follows the life of Felicia Turner, the matriarch of a close-knit family. Many of them leave this island for El Norte, the United States, after a revolution. Since this novel mirrors a lot of what happened to Medina's own family, I asked him what they hoped revolution would bring to Cuba in the late 1950s.
My family was middle class, and as members of that class, they were very much interested in ending corruption, in establishing a democratic government, and in living a sort of a calm, peaceful life, which was not quite what was happening, certainly after 1956 in Havana of those days. It was a very uncertain place and a very anxious place because you never knew when you would find a political demonstration on the street or a shootout or a bomb going off and so on and so forth. So they wanted it into that. Above all, they wanted it into the corruption that they saw was undermining the fabric of Cuban society.
So when Castro overthrew the Batista government, did your family celebrate?
Oh, of course. We spent about a week celebrating and partying and driving to and fro throughout the city, watching the rebels come in and buying mementos of the revolution and so on. So it was a great time. It was just a great party that was going on, and we were all very happy that the rebels had defeated Batista and that Batista was out of the island.
In the novel, the little boy Anton, he attends school, and after mm-hmm. the revolution, he comes home and he tells his parents about a course called political awareness. And there's
right.
certain catchphrases. One, the struggle of the proletariat, the curse of capitalism. His parents begin to worry. Were your parents worried about the turn the revolution took?
Yes, they were. You must understand for the Cuban middle class, as for the middle class in just about any Western country, communism was the boogeyman. And communism was the big, ugly creature that was just kind of stalking us in the island. And so when all these phrases and all these statements were made, both in classrooms and over TV and in political speeches, people started worrying. Many of them decided that it was better to leave the island than to be exposed to the possibility of communism.
Your family left Cuba in 1960. Was there a certain event that forced their decision?
No, there were just a series of events, such as a number of people from the militia coming to our house and taking inventory of all the furniture, and people coming to the door and asking questions about my father and so on and so forth. So that made us feel quite uncomfortable, and my parents were afraid that at any moment something bad would happen.
What did they want to know about your father?
They wanted to know things like where he worked and who he associated with, who his friends were, basically. Nothing specific. You know, they wouldn't ask questions like, was he involved in the counter-revolutionary activity? They wouldn't be that obvious. But they were just kind of asking. And that was rather disturbing, particularly since it never really happened before.
Was he a critic of the new government?
By this point, he had changed his mind, although he was a supporter at first, as was my mother.
In your story, I know, or your own story, your family left by airplane. Do you remember that day? Do you remember leaving? And you were 12 years old?
Absolutely. I remembered it as if it were yesterday. It was that kind of day. You were leaving behind a whole life, and you were coming to the United States, which was also very exciting.
Well, Anton, your character in the novel, who's leaving with his family and to go to El Norte, to America, he can only take a few things. He takes a book and a baseball glove.
Mm-hmm.
I assume you could only take a few things.
Yeah.
Do you remember what you took?
I brought a book, as a matter of fact. Not a book that I was particularly close to, but it was a book. As I recall, it was a book by Will Durant.
Hmm.
And I don't know why I picked that book of all the books that I might have brought. It's still a mystery to me.
And that's the only thing you took?
Other than, we were allowed clothes, a bag of clothes, which we, of course, brought. And as I recall, that's all I brought.
Well, I want to have you read another section from your novel, and this is about Anton. They're getting ready to leave this Caribbean island to go to America.
Okay. Later, while his parents were sleeping on the bed next to him, Anton tried to think what lay ahead. He wanted grand avenues and skyscrapers, bridges and factories. He wanted America and all its industrial power, its democratic arrogance and Wild West roughness. He wanted Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday, Billy the Kid and the James Brothers, Elliot Ness, Al Capone, Babyface Nelson, Mickey Mantle, and Warren Spahn. He wanted right and wrong to do battle out in the open where he could see them. He wanted a baseball, white and hard and perfect, to come flying in his direction so he could catch it and save the game. It was the early 60s, and he was in the country where all of this was possible. He knew it from the movies and from television, Key West and its sad streets notwithstanding. He knew it, too, from some place inside him neither his parents nor his grandmother had ever touched. El Norte was the way into the pure self.
What do you mean by that, El Norte was the way into the pure self?
Well, I meant it in the sense that in this island where he is coming from, Anton is fixed in a web where the self matters in relation to the family, to the extended family. But it seems to me And this perhaps is something that I sort of injected into Anton himself, that in this North American society, there's less of that. There's less of a web, of a family web that holds you. And so one is driven to seek out one's own internal mechanism, which most people call the self, whatever that is. And I think it's the United States is a place where this can happen. It's much more difficult to do in a country where the self is constantly being modified and driven and sometimes limited by the web of family.
Well, I want to talk some more, but let's just take a short break first. And our guest on Fresh Air today is Pablo Medina, and his latest book is a novel. It's his first novel. It's called The Marks of Birth. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Pablo Medina is our guest. He's a writer, essayist, poet, and now a novelist. His first novel is just written. It's called The Marks of Birth. Well, we're kind of going back and forth between your novel and your life, but let me just talk a little bit about what it was like for you to come to the United States in 1960. You were 12 years old. First of all, how good was your English?
It was fairly good, and I was very fortunate that way. I attended, I think my parents had the foresight to send me and my sister to bilingual schools in Cuba. It gave us a great education, and it also taught us language in a general sense, and in a more particular sense, it taught us English. So by the time we came here, we were fairly fluent. We just needed to get used to the language of the everyday, the language of the streets, so to speak.
What was your neighborhood like? You lived in New York City?
At first for almost a year we lived in Manhattan, and it was just a regular neighborhood. I say that and realize now that it was a rather fancy neighborhood. We were housed in a very expensive residential hotel right off a couple of blocks away from Fifth Avenue.
How'd you manage that?
Well, my father worked for a Spanish company, and they were gracious enough to pay for this hotel, though we were very poor. We just didn't have very much money for anything, but we certainly lived very nicely.
Well, you said you knew English. Did you feel that you fit in?
One always thinks at the moment that one fits in. In retrospect, of course, the story is very different. We did not fit in, and one can say that the whole history of our struggle, as well as the struggle of any exile, I think, is an attempt to reconcile one's past with one's present, and sometimes that's impossible.
Well, especially if you're cut off from your past the way you were.
Exactly. If that happens, it is very difficult to bring them together, so to speak.
But you didn't realize that back then, and I guess what 12-year-old would?
No, of course not. One tried to survive. One tried to thrive, if possible. One tried to wear all the masks that are necessary for survival. And I did. I did as best I could.
So you look like a regular American kid, so to speak?
Yeah, until I mentioned my name.
Well, what was the reaction when you mentioned your name?
Well, usually there would be some comment as to my background and where I was from and so on, and people would then try their Spanish on me, like, hola, ¿qué tal?
When did you begin to write?
Well, it's hard to answer that question in the sense that I always wrote. A better question would be, when did I start considering myself a writer?
Mm-hmm.
And that happened in college. It happened, I remember one time, I was a biology major in college, pre-med. And I was studying for an organic chemistry exam. At the same time, I was also taking a graduate seminar in Don Quixote.
Huh.
And there was the night before this big exam, I placed my organic chemistry textbook on the left of me and Don Quixote to the right of me. And I asked myself a question, what do you really want to do? Read Don Quixote or read organic chemistry? And of course, I read Don Quixote and failed the organic chemistry exam miserably, and the rest is history.
And you never looked back?
I
never had any
back.
Regrets?
I have never had any regrets. The only, you know, I've always been intrigued by medicine, and I've always liked that field. But I'm glad I'm not a doctor. I'm very happy to be a writer.
You live in Miami now, is that right?
Yes, though not for long, but I will. I have been living there for 2 years.
And there's certainly a large Cuban community there.
Very much so.
Does that feel like home then for you? Are there the kinds of sounds and smells and foods that make it feel like home?
Yes, there are all those sounds and smells. But let me tell you something. I moved to Miami thinking that for the first time in my life I would be in the majority and that I wouldn't feel like a foreigner. Well, I moved to Miami, and indeed, I was in the majority, and I have felt more of a foreigner there than I ever did.
What about for your child or your children? You mentioned your son. I don't know if you have other children as well.
I have one son.
One son.
Mm-hmm.
You said you feel like a foreigner in Miami. How does he feel?
Well, I think he probably feels a foreigner, but for very, very different reasons. He was born in this country, and he's very, very much an American, though, of course, he speaks both languages and speaks them well. And of late, he's sort of become very very interested in his Hispanic background. So, but that even proves that he feels foreign to that culture. The fact that he's interested in it is something he wants to get into.
Yeah. Does that surprise you at all, or is it interesting to watch him try to make sense of these dual cultures?
Oh, I love it, and I see him growing in that direction, and it's very good. You know, growth is very important in any direction you go in, and he happens to be going in a direction that pleases me as a father.
Well, I thank you, Pablo Medina, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you, Marty. It's been a pleasure.
Pablo Medina's novel is called The Marks of Birth. This is Fresh Air. Coming up on All Things Considered, President Clinton and Senate Minority Leader Bob Dole faced off over health care today in Massachusetts. There will be a report. Also, reporter Ira Glass finishes his series of reports from Taft High School in Chicago. NPR's Michael Scholar is in Zaire, where hundreds of thousands of Rwandan refugees have fled. He reports that Rwandan radio have been inciting people to leave Rwanda, saying the French can't be trusted. Also, Robert Siegel gets to the bottom of the missing corked bat story in Cleveland, and we'll hear from the Reduce Shakespeare Company. That's all coming up later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Writer Howard Norman got the inspiration for his second novel, The Bird Artist, nearly two decades ago when he was staying in an abandoned church in Newfoundland and saw an unsigned painting there of an ibis, dated 1911. An old woman told him that the artist had long ago been charged with the murder of the village lighthouse keeper. Norman took that nugget of local lore and fashioned it into a tale of passion and penance set against a cold northern seascape. Critic Maureen Corrigan has this review.
It would be curious if somewhere in this review I didn't compare this novel set in Newfoundland to that other best-selling, mega award-winning novel set in Newfoundland that everyone's reading in paperback this summer, E. Annie Proulx's The Shipping News. The trouble is, I can't seem to get past page 70 of The Shipping News. I know this is my fault. I have a knee-jerk aversion toward fictional characters with whimsical features, and Proulx's hero has a gargantuan chin. Friends tell me if I only read a little bit further into the book, I won't be able to put it down. I'm really trying, and that's something I didn't have to do with The Bird Artist. From the very first paragraph, I was hooked by the peculiar, stoic voice of the narrator. Here's how he introduces himself. My name is Fabian Voss. I live in Witless Bay, Newfoundland. You would not have heard of me. Obscurity is not necessarily failure, though. I am a bird artist and have more or less made a living at it. Yet I murdered the lighthouse keeper, Botho August, and that is an equal part of how I think of myself. Once he's captured our attention with that startling confession, Fabian slowly spins out a series of bewitching stories. He describes growing up during the turn of the century in the isolated fishing outpost of Witless Bay, where the mail is brought in every few months by boat. Its 200 inhabitants still sprinkle their conversations with old English words. And not too long before Fabian's time, there was a parrot living in town who was the last known speaker of the native Indian dialect. Fabian tells us how he learned to draw birds by taking a correspondence course, and how he eventually fell in love with a whiskey-guzzling local girl named Margaret. But their romance breaks apart like a wave on rocks when Fabian enters his bedroom one night and finds a photograph of an unfamiliar woman on his nightstand. It turns out she's his distant cousin, Cora, and his parents have pledged him to her in an arranged marriage. And when Fabian meets Cora for the first time in a boarding house on their wedding day, it's every bit as chilling as when he shoots that lighthouse keeper. What these plot highlights can't convey to you is the transfixing sensation of reading The Bird Artist. It's like listening to one of those weird medieval ballads where there are lots of puzzling narrative gaps filled in by a heavy atmosphere of predestined doom. The inhabitants of Witless Bay don't analyze their often erratic actions. Maybe it's because they live in a pre-therapeutic age, or maybe they're just too cold to do too much talking. So one moment, Fabian's mother is sitting by the fire knitting a shawl. The next, she's out every night having an affair. No excuses. But you grow accustomed to this novel's silence. It tells us as much about human behavior as any other method we have now. At one point, after the murder, when Fabian and his mother are making a nighttime getaway by boat, he tells us he felt like the boatman was smuggling my mother and me into a deeper incomprehension of our lives. That's a pretty good description of what this strange novel does, too.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Bird Artist by Howard Norman. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Audrey Bentham, and Chris Fraley. Mark Tullis does our research. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscowane.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, conversing with the planets, the myths, poems, and imagery we use to explain the night sky. Anthony Aveni's new book looks at the places in space where science, culture, and mythology coincide. I'm Marty Moscow, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.